the Victorian Country Hour with Warwick Long on ABC Radio Victoria.
Good afternoon to you. The federal government says Victoria has signed on, but Victoria says the federal government has backed down. So what is going on in the latest deal around the Murray-Darling Basin? What has been given by way of negotiation? We're going to try and get to the bottom of that with the Victorian Water Minister, Harriet Shing, in just a moment's time. If you've got skin in the game on this, what do you want to hear from the Minister, or what do you want the Victorian Government to do? You can send us a text 0467 842 722. Or indeed, you can always call us if you want to talk basin plan issues, 1300 977 222. Plus today, pretty big day in the calendar. 20 years ago, a sheep was found in the New Zealand High Country and it became world famous. If you haven't heard about Shrek the Sheep, have I got a story for you today. This sheep became so famous, it had its own car, had its own diet, got its own house, had a higher appearance fee. If you wanted Shrek to come to an event in New Zealand, it cost you more than getting an All Blacks player. The New Zealand rugby league team, the most famous people in New Zealand, were less expensive than getting a sheep. It's an extraordinary tale. We'll speak to the farmer involved today. As always, as I said, send me a text if you want to be involved. 0467 842 722.
The Victorian Country Hour with Warwick Long on ABC Radio Victoria.
Yeah, the federal government says Victoria has signed on to the new deal on the basin plan, but Victoria says the federal government have backed down. What by way has been given in way of negotiation? What does this latest deal mean for the state? Is there a return to buybacks? Are projects that will be funded by the federal government going to deliver water for the environment? What has been given away by way of negotiation? Harriet Shing is the Victorian Water Minister and could join you on the Country Hour to talk through these details. Harriet Shing, what does this latest deal mean?
The Commonwealth's announcement last week is really welcome news for Victoria, not just for Victorian environments, but also for food producers and for communities. The Commonwealth has agreed to fund our Victorian Murray floodplain restoration projects. These are really important projects that get water onto about 14,000 hectares of our floodplains. And because they use pumps and regulators, we don't need large-scale flooding over the banks of our rivers in order to get that water to where it's needed. This means that as our climate dries, we'll be in a position to make sure that there is water across these landscapes, that we do see fish and migratory birds and black box and red gum being able to survive. And it's a really important part of making sure that Victorian environments are in a position to flourish, and everybody in the basin communities across the north of Victoria knows that where we have healthy waterways and healthy environments, we have healthy communities and we have healthy industry as well.
So this would come about via negotiation, right? Every state had signed up to the Federal Water Minister Tanya Plibersek's new version of the Basin Plan. Victoria was the holdout, so you didn't get funding for these projects while you held out. So what has been negotiated to get this funding now?
The Commonwealth indicated to other states that it was prepared to fund various projects where they had signed up to an agreement that was put to basin states last August. Victoria did not sign up to this agreement. We have not signed up to this agreement, and we will not sign up to this agreement. We welcome the Commonwealth's agreement, however, that these projects are necessary. There are no conditions attached to these funding agreements that will be put in place for watering our floodplains. And it's been really great that the Commonwealth has finally recognised the value of these projects that will return about 70 gig into the system to make sure that we are, in fact, delivering on environmental and better outcomes, not just for Victoria, but for the whole basin. So it's not a question of a deal having been done. This is, however, just a welcome acknowledgement from the Commonwealth that these projects warrant funding and that it would be the right thing to do. But we haven't given up anything in the process.
So hold on a second. Every other state had to sign up to the federal government's new plan on the Murray-Darling in order to get their funding. You're saying Victoria hasn't and still hasn't, yet you're getting the money anyway?
That's correct.
So why do you think the federal government backed down and gave you the funding you were looking for?
Well, it is in the Commonwealth's interests for these projects to proceed. As I said, it's about 70 gigalitres of water, and this means valuable environmental outcomes and a measure of resilience for Victorian communities. And the Basin Plan has to be about environments all the way across the basin. Up in New South Wales, we do need to see the water resource plans from that state government submitted. We need to see that when we deliver the Murray-Darling Basin Plan together, we're doing it in a way that brings water to the Darling, to the Barker. We can't send it upstream because all of our water heads to South Australia. But what we can do is demand and require and ask for and advocate for water to be sent from the Northern Basin through the Darling and the Barker to see those riverine environments improved as well. And I want to see that we can continue to benefit communities into the future and to do so in a way that makes sure that no state is disadvantaged through the implementation of Commonwealth decision making.
Is the Victorian government still against the idea of further federal government water buybacks?
Victoria remains opposed to buybacks. We know from the impact of the earlier round of buybacks in Victoria, 550 gig, that they caused wide-scale job losses and economic downturn. There was a consequence for individual irrigators across systems where their assets were sweated and lost because water was removed from the consumptive pool. And in fact, they were left to carry the cost of irrigation infrastructure and programs. We remain opposed to buybacks. Our position has not changed. And this is something that we will continue to make clear to the Commonwealth and that where Commonwealth legislation is to be implemented around buybacks, where the Commonwealth is entering the water market, that this has to be done in a way that considers socioeconomic impact and also that provides the best measure of support for the states where those buybacks are going to occur. And that's why in Victoria we'll be negotiating with the Commonwealth on, as I said, the detail of those buybacks to make sure that where there are opportunities for water to be returned, for environmental water to be purchased, that this is done in a way that doesn't cause detriment, that where we can, we look to projects that can provide efficiencies, projects that can deliver the outcomes for the basin, and that we do so in a way that prioritises those projects. And also, we need to make sure that we're delivering on the initial commitments under the plan, that 2750 gigalitres of water. Victoria's returned more environmental water than any other jurisdiction. We have done this despite the impacts of floods and of border closures. And we've put hundreds of thousands of hours of work into developing these floodplain watering projects. We've also got the most rigorous and transparent system of water monitoring, of compliance. We've cracked down on floodplain harvesting and we're doing more than any other state to make sure that that remains the case. We're really determined to share that with other jurisdictions as well, and I've extended that offer to the Commonwealth and to other states, as well as traditional owner access to water too. And that's a really important part of the work that we want to see happen as part of a wholesale commitment over the long term from the Commonwealth Government to address the importance of traditional owner access to water.
So the federal government believes it can go and buy back water anyway, even if your government is against it. Will you be looking for some negotiation with the government on that point that you were just speaking about there, the idea that their buybacks could, if they're going to do it, could be more strategic in your state?
What we do want to see is that buybacks that occur in Victoria are negotiated with the Victorian government to minimise socioeconomic impact. Now, there were really important amendments negotiated as part of the passage of that legislation that require the Commonwealth to consider the impact of socioeconomic impact across any state where buybacks are to occur. And this is where we've got opportunities, whether it's sleeper licences or operating rules, whether it's specific locations where buybacks may be able to occur across systems where we don't have what's called a Swiss cheese effect, where some people are left to carry the cost and the loss of buybacks because others in that channel system sell their water, that we can and indeed will work with the Commonwealth so that they do understand what the impact of those changes might be. I also am looking to the Murray-Darling Basin Authority to really meaningfully engage with Victorian communities and to have a very detailed and respectful discussion about next steps from here, that as the detail is prepared and released by the Commonwealth, communities are made aware of it, that we do see a better presence from the MDBA in our rural communities, and that the Commonwealth is also actively on the ground.
So where to from here? What are the next steps then for this relationship between the state and the federal governments?
Well, firstly, it is about picking up that work to build on the hundreds of thousands of hours of effort that have already gone into those floodplain restoration projects, those environmental watering projects.
And these are projects that save water for the environment, so fewer buybacks are required.
Yeah, correct. This essentially reduces by about 70 gigalitres the amount that the Commonwealth had otherwise thought it was going to need to buy back. So the projects stack up and they make sense, not just for Victoria, but for other basin states as well. It's then also about making sure that when we enter into discussions and negotiations with the Commonwealth, we're doing that in good faith and for a proper purpose. And again, the best way, to my mind, to do that is with a ministerial council. So I want to make sure that we are able to sit around a table. As I think I've said to you before, I've never walked away from the table. I'm determined to be joined by others to talk about what we can do, but also what we have done.
Are there more projects out there that could attract government funding if this proves to be a fruitful exercise?
Absolutely. And this is where, again, I've been having conversations and discussions with our water authorities, our CMAs, councils, irrigators groups, people on the ground in rural and regional Victoria for a very long time now. And there are projects that will, in fact, enable us to deliver that benefit with a reduced amount of damage to communities.
Well, Minister, it's been good to talk to you today. Thanks very much for joining us on the program.
Always a pleasure, Warwick.
Victorian Water Minister Harriet Shing speaking to you there. Interesting. And I wonder what you make of that. The idea that all the other states to sign up to Tanya Plibersek's, the Federal Water Minister's reset of the Basin Plan, didn't get money from the federal government unless they signed on that line to basically say this is the new plan, and then they got their funding in return. Victoria, the minister was pretty clear then, saying we didn't sign up to anything and now the federal government's going to fund us anyway. I don't really know if we got to the bottom of what that means long term from here. I think we need to keep looking at that in terms of what it means for buybacks, in terms of what it means for future projects. But a lot of interesting information in there. I wonder what you make of it. 1300 977 222. If you want to call, you can text 204 67 842 722. This text saying, correction, jobs are the best thing for the community, and those jobs flow on from irrigation. Fred also saying, Basin Plan project process is correct. Carry water traders and the environment hold most of the water in storages. This is going to cause future flooding, says Fred on the text. Oh, and Ian, I'll get to your text later. I hope I really didn't say that, Ian, but we'll get to that. Controversy. Let's go to Malcolm first. 1300 977 222 from Wangaratta. G'day, Malcolm.
Thanks, Warwick. Warwick, what no one's telling the public, or the minister didn't say then, is the fact that New South Wales and Victoria, we've got two separate different rules as far as groundwater and surface water. So when you put a ban on surface water in Victoria, you cannot pump out of a bore or a well or something with a close proximity of a river. In New South Wales, even after they sell their surface water and the river goes on the Darling or the Macquarie, goes on a total irrigation ban, they're still pumping water out of the ground only 80 metres
from the river. It's an interesting point you raise, that the minister did sort of subtly refer to that in the sense of saying they can't make water flow up the Darling, basically pointing the finger at New South Wales and Queensland to do more lifting there. But clearly that's probably more up to the federal government than the Victorian government. But interesting thought all the same. Malcolm, thank you very much for your call. I better keep moving. 1300 977 222, though, if you would like to call us here on the program. Move away from water and talk about energy transmission right now. Last week on the program, You heard the news that the VNI West Transmission Line project will proceed in Victoria after an independent review identified shortcomings with a proposed alternative. The state government initiated the review last year after prominent energy expert Professor Bruce Mountain called for the project to be scrapped and outlined an alternative plan for electricity transmission known as Plan B. The review found Plan B had underestimated the benefits of the VNI West project and would present its own risks and challenges. And Mr. Mountain joined Elsie Kennedy to talk about the review of his review, which he says has serious flaws.
It was described as an independent assessment. We were invited as observers to the assessment, but we sought clarification of the terms of reference, and we sought to be involved in the reporting of the advisers to the government, and both were actually refused. So we don't think it's reasonable to call it an independent assessment. It was a consultancy hired by the government who answered to the government.
If we can talk briefly about the findings from the review found that it disagreed with your argument that there was no value in the interconnection that VNI West was providing between Victoria and New South Wales. It found that that interconnection was valuable for a number of different reasons. What's your response to that?
Essentially, they did not put forward any evidence to justify that the value of the diversity in production between the two states could justify the cost. We've not said that there's no value in it. Our point is that the value does not exceed the cost, and we've substantively set that out.
One of the particular things that they've highlighted in terms of the value of linking up the two states is are projects like offshore wind. And so you have this influx of power coming from those projects at a certain amount of time. They say it's really valuable to be able to then export that to another state if you have an oversupply. You think that's not a good argument?
That sounds good, doesn't it? But let's be clear on the analysis here done by the energy market operator. The energy market operator, in assessing the benefits and the costs of VNI West, did sums which excluded any offshore wind in their central scenario. And the essence of the calculation of the benefits from the energy market operator is that Victoria becomes a substantial importer from the other states. In fact, it becomes such a substantial importer that by 2035, 26% of the Victorian electricity use will be imported. That's a massive change. Now, that's saying that the benefit lies in importing. Most critically, the government has said that that is wrong. Victoria will not be an importer. It will continue to be an exporter. But how then to reconcile the government saying VNI West can be justified on EMO's analysis? You can't say we will be an exporter, but then actually rely on sums done by the energy market operator, which says the benefit of VNI West lies in us importing.
One of the things I point out is that to go through with your proposal would involve a big increase in battery storage in the order of four times the Victorian energy storage target for 2035. Is that something that you factored in when you were putting together your proposal?
So the essence of that argument is that there is a diversity in production from one state to the other, which means that you don't need to build the storage. There is no meaningful diversity in solar production and the wind production. You can see evidence in the market is not worthwhile because they are actually doing it at the same time. What EMO claimed in their analysis on the VNI West benefit is they said that VNI West would allow cheaper storage to be built in New South Wales than in Vic. And so the advantage of the interconnection, at least in respect of Victoria, was that cheaper storage would be built out there. But storage can be built for the same cost in both states. So how can it be that interconnection allows you to access cheaper battery storage built in another state? We know, and EMO's own analysis and their own input assumptions show that storage can be built for the same cost everywhere.
At this point, the review has essentially dismissed your proposal, which means the government would be going ahead with its original plan for the V&I West. What would you like to happen from here?
To be perfectly honest, I think it's now in the hands of the interested parties, which are the, I think in the main, the landowners who are impacted by this.
That is Elsie Kennedy speaking to Bruce Mountain. A VicGrid spokesperson said in a statement that the Reviewers Commission was independent and found the Plan B proposal does not measure up. The terms of reference for the review are available to read online with VicGrid. You're listening to the Country Hour, Warwick Long with you on the program. Plenty of texts coming in. We'll get to that later in the program. You're going to hear the story of Shrek the Sheep, 20 years since that sheep was found. It is an interesting tale of a farmer and a farm operation literally becoming the biggest story in the world for one day too, which I'd imagine is something that would many of you would dread, but a lot of learning in that from the farmer affected. So stay tuned for that. When I was plugging it, I was saying Shrek got so famous, the appearance fee for the sheep was higher than All Blacks players. And Ian from, I don't know where he's from, the mad rugby league fan, Ian, has pulled me up and said the All Blacks are the New Zealand rugby union side, not the rugby league side. Did I say rugby league, Ian? I'm sorry. I know it's the rugby side. I hope my father, who grew up playing rugby, did not hear that, or I won't be welcome home for family dinners anymore. But yes, All Blacks rugby union side, the most famous people in New Zealand. They didn't have an appearance fee as big as Shrek the Sheep. You can hear that story coming up in the program. Let's talk about taking fodder over borders right now, because this is an interesting tale for many of you, and particularly if you're newer to the farming game, you might want to know these details. Farmers planning to import grain or fodder from interstate are being urged to check in with Agriculture Victoria before purchasing their load or risk penalties under the Plant Biosecurity Act. Movement laws are currently in place to prevent the spread of weeds, pests and diseases, with many interstate hauls requiring a certificate signed by a biosecurity officer before crossing the border into Victoria. Jim Moran, Grains Industry Biosecurity Officer with AgVic, says weather conditions since late last year have affected the quality and quantity of available local fodder, resulting in livestock producers looking interstate to meet that demand, and for that, they need to know the rules.
Livestock producers, intensive or broad acre, will be looking interstate for feed, whether it's grain, cereal hay, pasture hay, with variable supplies around the country with the inclement weather. So we would like people to talk to Agriculture Victoria biosecurity officers first, because if you're bringing feedstuffs in from other states, there are conditions set out in the Plant Biosecurity Act that essentially are trying to stop the spread of pests and diseases, but they must be met before that feedstuff can arrive in Victoria.
Are there any particular pests or diseases that you're concerned about, Jim?
Yeah, well, it varies from state to state, and a lot of states are free from the notifiable pests and diseases that we're concerned about. So it must be stressed that they have free movement without any restrictions, but depends on the pest or the disease. So it's variable and can get confusing, which is why we want people to call us for more information. But by way of an example, some states are free from annual ryegrass toxicity, which includes Queensland, Northern Territory, Tasmania. So they have been issued with an area freedom certificate, and they would have free movement into Victoria. Whereas, again, with this example of annual ryegrass toxicity, if it comes from New South Wales, Western Australia, South Australia, it will need to be inspected by their local compliance officer, biosecurity officer, and have a certificate issued so that it's safe and it meets our conditions and can then come into Victoria. And that's not a free service either. So it's a cost to think about when you're purchasing from interstate. And this is one of a few diseases that are covered under our plant biosecurity legislation.
Has Agriculture Victoria got biosecurity officers on the border?
We have at times, depending on what's going on, but not all the time. There isn't a fixed station there, as far as I'm aware, but South Australia do. And for anything coming in from Western Australia, let's say, it has to go across the South Australian border, transit through that state. So it's thoroughly inspected for quality and for pests and diseases and also for appropriate certification. So just because we're not always there doesn't mean things will get through, because other states are quite wary of their area freedom status.
You mentioned that it is of a cost to farmers to be able to get the certificates to lawfully get fodder, for example, from state to state. But there's also penalties in place for non-compliance, isn't there, Jim?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, if you knowingly bring in, for example, a noxious pest or weed or disease or something that's notifiable, then there will be an investigation and then obviously a prosecution. Worse than that, though, you are responsible for bringing in a pest or disease that's not here now and could cause widespread harm and damage to both the environment but also agriculture and the industry in Victoria. So we're sort of not looking at the stick approach, if you like. That's why we'd like people to ring us first to find out what the conditions might be on bringing stuff in to Victoria for their livestock, just to prevent any issues at all before it gets here or even after it gets here, because there's just too much at risk. And, well, as you know, the litany of examples of how quickly things, pests and diseases, can spread in the right environments and with the right vectors. So we'd rather have people ring first, and then we all know what's going on, and we can remain free from some of these pests and diseases.
That is Grains Industry Biosecurity Officer with Agriculture Victoria, Jim Moran there, speaking with Jane McNaughton. If you want more information, remember there is that Agriculture Victoria number 136 186 that you can ring and clarify information, 136 186, to get onto Agriculture Victoria. You're listening to The Country Hour. I'm going to tell you about the best steak in Australia. Well, it was awarded that at the Wagyu conference last week. It is quite the description. In fact, there were some big prices paid even for animals there, and I think you're going to hear about that in the middle of this bulletin of Rural News. Fiona Broom can tell you more. Good afternoon, Fiona.
Good afternoon, Woz. Making Rural News today, farmers in southwest Western Australia are running out of water and feed as drought conditions bite. Wayne Mitchell is an Elders WA livestock agent and the Mount Barker sale yard's head auctioneer. He says it's getting to the point where farmers are starting to make some tough decisions.
Season's ordinary at best. We've ended up in a situation that the spring cut off very, very early. We didn't get that bulk in spring, so we've been chasing our tails since September. And it's really starting to come home now. People are starting to make decisions on what they can hold and feed and what they can't. And there's an amount of producers now having to source hay and fodder and that have never, ever had to do it. It's getting to a point where some serious decisions are needing to be made.
WA Agriculture Minister Jackie Jarvis said she was aware of the issues farmers were facing. She says the state government has established a new task force to see what can be done.
I've asked Rob Cossart, CEO of the Wheatbelt Development Commission, to establish a 2024 dry season response task force to look at the current challenges that our farmers are facing across the state due to the hotter, drier weather conditions that we continue to experience here in Western Australia. I've asked the task force to look immediately at access to fodder for livestock across the state. We know that there are challenging climatic conditions across the state. I know southwest dairy producers and, as you said, cattle producers as far north as Gascoyne are having challenging times. It's a really difficult time for farmers in Western Australia.
A two-year-old Wagyu heifer has topped this year's elite Wagyu sale, selling for $130,000. Bred by Mayora Station in South Australia, the heifer was the top price at the sale, which grossed $1.38 million this year, with an average female price of $42,333. Matt McDonough is CEO of the Australian Wagyu Association. He says an American buyer paid top dollar.
Yeah, she's just supreme for several of the core traits that the Wagyu industry is looking to advance. And if we can move all of those traits forward together in an animal like that, she's worth a lot of money.
And she was bought by the Thomas family, who run a Wagyu operation in the United States. Now, how big of a deal is it for an overseas buyer to get involved?
Look, the opportunity is there to buy an animal like that heifer, get her into a reproduction center into Australia, and, you know, get some extremely high genetic merit embryos and genetic material to export back to the home country. So the sale to the Thomases at Santos Petronas is not unusual and really, really welcome.
Over to New Zealand, where dairy giant Fonterra has announced it's closing factories at Waikatoa. The company says the specialty powder plant in Waitoa and two major milk dryers at Te Rapa will close. Overall, around 41 jobs are affected by the closures. The dryers at Te Rapa were 60 years old, and the company says they've completed their life in manufacturing. The plant at Waitoa was 40 years old. And do you know what an insurance population is? We have insurance populations for all sorts of things, from storing grains in the Arctic Circle to raising endangered animals on islands. And was it's all to ensure species don't go extinct. And there are now plans to preserve the genetic heritage of Tasmania's rarest apples and pears. AgriGrowth's Assistant Director Caroline Brown says it's important work.
A lot of people would be aware of the Grove Heritage Orchard. The department has been operating that or has owned that property since 1951. And the collection comprises around 660 odd varieties of apple rootstocks, pear, quince, and crab apples, essentially pome fruits. And the collection has been in care and maintenance by the department. And we've been looking at, well, what is the importance of this collection, and are they in other orchards throughout Australia? So we're really trying to narrow down what are the really critical cultivars that are based at Grove and nowhere else. And this is what the insurance population project is about, really understanding, well, what are those critical ones that we really need to focus on to make sure that we're not losing that genetic diversity if, for example, we had an unfortunate situation like a bushfire.
And that's Rural News for today, Woz.
Thank you very much for that there, Fiona Broom, there with Rural News. Love the idea of Tasmania looking after some of those apple varieties. That's really interesting stuff. Bill in Benalla has sent a text on the Hey Biosecurity information from Agriculture Victoria saying, "Hi Warwick, how does that work? Biosecurity fines for bringing in hay with noxious weeds, but unmanned neighbours and their weed seeds can fly across the fence and the council doesn't care. Too many double standards." Says Bill as well. I can hear your frustration, Bill. Thanks for your text all the same. Chris, frustrated with the Victorian government conducting independent reviews around transmission lines, once more around turbine and those power line installations. You can keep them coming, 0467 842 722 if you want to send us a text as well. We've got a very expensive, very fatty sounding steak coming up for you on the program. But before that, let's find out how the weather's looking around our state this lunchtime and for the rest of the week. Stephanie Miles can tell us, senior forecaster on duty at the Weather Bureau. G'day, Stephanie.
How are you going, Warwick?
Yeah, good. How's it looking today? It's pretty much the same as yesterday. Feeling was in my part of Shepparton. Is that the same for everyone?
Very much the same for everyone, I think. It's unfortunate there's not really that much going on with the weather in the next maybe week or so, really. We're just under a high-pressure ridge at the moment, so it means we'll get some southwesterly to southerly winds impacting the southern parts of the state, and then the northern parts of the state remaining relatively settled. We do have a couple of troughs and a weak front coming through, though, so do expect a couple of showers to continue mostly on and south of the ranges from about tomorrow onwards and then through Wednesday and Thursday as well. But, yeah, other than that, it's really just cloudy and a little bit foggy in the south and then nice and sunny in the north, and our temperatures remaining around those mid to high 20s. So we've got around 20 degrees around the coast today and then up in the northern parts up to about 25, 26 degrees, and that just kind of continues for the rest of the week, Warwick. So, I mean, you're right, it's very repetitive and we've got not much going on still.
That's all right. That's all right. Heavy dews I'm starting to notice a lot where I am. Is that the case for a lot of people?
I would imagine so. It definitely looks like it when we come in the morning in the satellite imagery. But look, I mean, even this morning when I was walking to work, it was quite cool and fresh out there. So, yeah, look, a lot of them, you know, expected on the horizon. Not quite frost at the moment, perhaps in those very northern, you know, highest elevation areas at the moment when we've got those clear skies. But, you know, the minimum temperature is still around those 5 to 7 degrees at the moment.
So no warnings then, I'd imagine, today and really for the week?
Not really for the rest of the week, no. I mean, we might get some couple of stronger winds along the coastal waters a little bit later around Thursday, but, I mean, at the moment, no, nothing going on.
Nothing going on. Well, we'll take it, Stephanie. You know we will. That's great. If anyone has a question then, the weather reports sound this week like they're going to be quite short. You can send those texts in 0467 842 722, and I might take some of them and give them to you tomorrow, Stephanie.
Oh, we'd love that. Please do, everyone. Thanks so much, Warwick.
Thanks, Stephanie. Stephanie Miles there, Senior Forecaster at the Weather Bureau. Short weather report. It's pretty settled. It's going to be settled for a lot of this week, a lot of this kind of weather. It was a good week, good day to be out and about outside yesterday. So hopefully a lot of that for many of you this week if you get those opportunities. I said I was going to talk about a highly awarded steak, and we are going to do that right now here on the Country Hour. I'd love to know from you if you'd eat it. Does this sound good to you? As well, it's more fat than meat. You're going to hear those numbers. So while you're listening to it, flick us a text, 0467 842 722. Tell me if this steak sounds good to you. Because Mayura Station in South Australia, which, as you've just heard in Rural News, sold a $130,000 Wagyu heifer this week, has also been crowned the best steak in the country. Matt McDonough is the CEO of the Australian Wagyu Association. He had a chat with Matt Brand about this unique piece of meat and why you'd struggle to find a piece of it in Australia or even something similar. Here it is.
That piece of meat, it had two things which were really unique to it. The first thing, and so it was a full blood entry, that's not unique. We had about 15 full blood entries. This entry was the largest ever eye muscle that we'd seen in a steak that had been, or in a piece of meat that had been submitted to the Wagyu brand of beef competition. And it was 62% unsaturated fat. So the fat in that piece of steak was about 60% IMF anyway, so extremely high amount of fine marbling in a very large ribeye. And the marbling in the ribeye was over 60% unsaturated fat. So when you cook that piece of meat and eat it, it's literally dissolving in your mouth. The temperature of the mouth is more than the fat needs to become liquid and dissolve. So you get an extremely juicy, rich experience, extremely tender. It's almost like the meat's bursting in your mouth when you eat it. It's an incredible experience. And that piece of meat was just unique. We'd seen nothing like it before.
How much would that steak cost, do you think?
Look, I don't think I can afford to buy it. I think you would be lucky to get that piece of steak in Australia. If you could, you know, probably around $200 a kilo is what it would be worth retail to buy that, but it's not likely you could buy it retail. It'll be sold in extremely high-class restaurants around the world. So by the time you amplify up that cost, it's, you know, probably about $500 a kilo or more if you wanted to buy and eat that steak in a restaurant, but you just probably couldn't buy it any other way.
And could you actually sit down and eat that much Wagyu with a 60% marbling?
Oh, heck no. No, yeah. You can't. So that's the interesting thing about Wagyu is on a steak that big, A, it's enormous, and B, you can't eat much of it. So typically what we're seeing with these really super high quality Wagyu offerings, like really big ribeyes, you know, enormous T-bones, 3 kilogram tomahawks, is you'll have a table of 10 people sitting around a hero dish, like a Wagyu tomahawk that's marble score 9+ off the charts. And that steak will be cooked. It will come out on a massive timber board and it will be sliced by the chef and the kitchen staff at a high-class restaurant into slices. And it's very much a share meal hero beef experience. It's a new way of experiencing steak, which I really enjoy, is the ability for everybody to sit around and share a meal together. It's just a great situation, and Wagyu slots right into that.
That's Matt McDonough, CEO of Wagyu Australia, speaking to Matt Brand there. That is incredible. 62% unsaturated fat is part of the steak. And because your mouth's so warm, it melts the fat. Does that sound good to you? I'll tell you what, I always say I'd try anything once. I'd be lining up to try this one. I'm interested in what you think. That's the most awarded steak that was handed out at the Australian Wagyu Association event in North Queensland last week. 0467 842 722. It was Homer's drooling. Since that text, Brian Venus Bay says, if we had this steak, our staffy would be very excited. Oh, if the wife had this steak, our staffy would be very excited. Does that mean that she cuts a lot of the fat off, Brian? Is that what you're inferring there? Interesting comments, liking it all. Let's move away from the steak and talk some sheep now. It's been 20 years, pretty much to the day, since the discovery of an unshorn sheep captured the world's attention and put a farmer into the spotlight like never before. Shrek the Sheep was world famous, being discovered in the wilds of New Zealand carrying nearly a 30-kilogram fleece. His rise to fame saw his shearing broadcast to 1.2 billion people, his own car for travel, two statues, and an appearance fee that was even larger than New Zealand Rugby Union's All Black players in his own country, which is incredible. I had a chat to John Perriam from Bendigo Station on the South Island of New Zealand to reminisce a lot about Shrek and really what he meant to agriculture.
It was a story. It wasn't the weight of his wool. He was carrying 27 kilos, which was huge, but it was a power of the story. He was lost in the hills. He was found, saved by Hans Gamlin.
High up in mountainous sheep country on New Zealand's South Island, on this day, 20 years ago, staff found a sheep that hadn't had a haircut in a very long time. They were working for Bendigo Station owner John Perriam.
For those people in Australia that have been here, Central Otago, it's very mountainous, and he had been hiding up there for 5 years at 5,000 feet. Pretty incredible, really. And we found him on the autumn muster, which we went out for daylight this time 20 years ago, and found him, brought him back down to the ram shed at Bendigo, the station, and we'd be wondering what we're going to do with him because he was just a big bundle of wool, quite useless.
The discovery of this sheep was one thing, but no one knew what they were about to get. Shrek was about to be world famous, named by some visiting backpackers, photographed by the local paper. A quirky story on a local farm was suddenly a worldwide phenomenon.
He just started moving back towards the trailer, and Digger said, "I bet you can't carry that thing over your shoulders." So Cage looked at him with disdain and picked Shrek up over his shoulders, and Steve and Jack Ray just saw the moment and got that one photograph. It looked like an alien over this guy's shoulders, and that Otago Daily Times front page the next day. Then Reuters picked it all around the world within 24-48 hours. Was bizarre.
It's incredible. So that one moment and getting that one photo is almost what made Shrek so famous. And when we talk about so famous, he's one of the only sheep really to be shorn on television, right? Like, what happened from there? What do you remember of what happened from there?
Well, once it became global and the phone started ringing and it took a lot of handling, the media were so fascinated with it from all over the world. We had an ABC team there from Australia, same from Japan. They all wanted a bit of the action. But then I got a ring from a well-known presenter in New Zealand, Paul Holmes at the time, and he said, "Hey, mate, what do you think we share this sheep in front of the world?" And I said, "Well, you're mad, because it's just something you don't do, is share a sheep in front of the world. Anything could happen and go wrong." And of course, he hadn't been shorn for 5 years, so he had very loose skin on him. All the farmers started ringing me up saying, "Don't do it, John." And, you know, Paul Holmes was determined to get Dave Fagan to share him, who was our New Zealand's champion machine shearer. I had to front up with Holmes and said, "Look, sorry, I've got another friend who's also a champion blade shearer. It's much safer to share him with blades and leaves more wool on him." So that's what happened. But at any rate, it got televised to 1.2 billion people around the world, which was quite incredible. So it was just the power of the story was quite incredible.
You heard that right. When Shrek was shorn live on CNN and other television networks, it was broadcast to over 1.2 billion people. This sheep producer suddenly had in his possession a superstar, and it didn't stop there. Shrek's fame continued for the rest of his life.
He then went on to be probably the most airports from anybody in New Zealand, flying all over the country, raising funds for cure kids. And that was a great journey for 7 years.
Yeah, he became super famous, didn't he? The meeting the Prime Minister, going around the country. Shrek was a celebrity in his own right.
Well, he loved people, and he had no fear of people. We eventually bought him his own Jeep Cherokee. He'll stand there with us, looking between the bucket seats out the front window. He didn't travel in the trailer behind a car or anything like that. He always had to be tried in place and lead the front of the red rope. And even from the time we went the second day after Sean, took him over to Queenstown, everybody wanted a part of him. And then we suggested that maybe the Prime Minister would like to meet him and have a parliamentary reception, which she did, and she was great. Callum Clark. In fact, that became a very famous moment.
Is there not one but two statues dedicated to Shrek?
Yes, he's got one big bronze at Bendigo at the station where he's found, and there's been another one made. And we're looking at an occasion. We still have Shrek's ashes, and in his last will and testament, he wanted his ashes to be spread on the top of Mount Cook in New Zealand, the highest mountain, where he could look over all his ancestors.
When did Shrek die?
He lived on for 7 years after he was found, which made him the oldest sheep in New Zealand. But we looked after him very carefully. He had his own, it was a purpose-built shed with a brand around it. He never went outside for 7 years. And he was fed on chaff, rolled oats and lucerne. And that was a staple diet, which was low protein, and a lot of people could learn from that. But he did, I think, in equivalent human terms, he was 90 years old.
But the rise of fame of Shrek to around the world wasn't without controversy. Disney, the Hollywood company that is known to defend its brands seriously, threatened legal action for the use of the name Shrek. But by then, the sheep was raising money for charity, and a deal was worked out.
Yeah, DreamWorks solicitors, several days later, yeah, they weren't very happy about it, understandably, but because it hadn't been deliberate. Fortunately, that stage had been turned to charity and to CureKids, and CureKids solicitors in New Zealand were Russell McVeigh. And so Russell McVeigh and the DreamWorks solicitors squared off, and they all agreed that it was a great story, good for New Zealand, good for the world, and there was nothing deliberate. We agreed and signed off that we wouldn't use the name for any commercial purposes except for raising funds for charity.
And how much money do you think Shrek raised for charity over his life?
One of our marketing gurus in New Zealand and published it that he felt that he was worth over $100 million to the New Zealand economy. That's the story. You know, in cash terms, he raised hundreds of thousands for CureKids, and in profile also raised much more to CureKids. So we got to a point where he was earning more. He was more than an All Black appearance to make an appearance anywhere in New Zealand, $20,000.
Yes, Shrek the Sheep's appearance fee in New Zealand got above $20,000 per appearance, with the money raised going to CureKids, the charity. John Perriam, the farmer, the owner of Shrek, says his impact cannot be overstated.
I think there's a time when we're looking for good news, and we're still looking for good news. So Shrek's story lives on, and I'm pretty proud of that. He was one of the best looked after sheep in the world. I personally fed him night and day for 7 years. He was just, he couldn't be a better, almost human, the way he went into hospitals and retirement homes, go down the hallway, walk into the rooms, nuzzle up to the bed. People would just start crying in their beds. They were just so, the power of Shrek was so strong at that stage. Yeah, when you look back, it was bizarre, but it was real.
It was bizarre, but it was real. That's John Perriam from Bendigo Station in New Zealand, in the central highlands of the South Island. Former owner of Shrek the Sheep, having a chat about that sheep's impact. Huge. Broadcast to over a billion people. He's shearing, had his own car, Jeep Cherokee, because he wanted to ride in the front seat. Two statues, an appearance fee that was larger than All Blacks players, and had a will at his death saying he wanted his ashes scattered on the highest peak of New Zealand. That sheep had it all. Very interesting story indeed. You've got very interesting comments to make about that expensive steak too. 62% unsaturated fat would melt in your mouth. I said, are you keen on that? Marty says, I didn't need that Wagyu steak story. I forgot my lunchbox. Perhaps catch myself some primetime rabbit if I'm lucky. Sorry, Marty. Macca says, Warwick, you've got to have good marbling in your steak or lamb. Says ex-butcher Macca. Love that. Dan from Albury says, marbling steak, don't care how much you pay for it. Marbling equals fat. Give me lean rump or porterhouse steak any day. Can't handle fatty tasting steaks, and I'm not paying for a fatty steak. Sorry, Woz, but that's on the verge of value. We'll just keep growing our own good value Angus. Cheers, says one text. See, we used to think that about Angus people too back in the day, anonymous texter. But it's all good. All the same. Bob says, sorry, quality Wagyu meat is a relative term. I'll take roux steak and plum sauce anytime. Oh, Bob, see, that sounds great to me too. Thank you very much for that. A lot of texts coming in. Haven't gotten to them all because we need to get to markets. Let's start with the sheep and lamb markets today, and Jenny Kelly.
Good afternoon. Not good news for producers today, with the new Iran and Israel conflict in the Middle East stopping air freight and taking $20 to $40 off light and MK-style lambs. Playing trade lambs under 24 kilos carcass weight also took a fair price hit of around $15 a head, while the heavier slaughter lambs over 26 kilos held up better as they are destined for other markets like the US, easing 6 to 10. Supply-wise, there was 14,500 lambs and 6,300 sheep. Heavy mutton was also 10 to 15 cheaper, while trade sheep eased 5. All up, it was a fairly erratic market, with all the talk from the buying group centred around the disruption to the Middle East, including reports some processors are having meat flown back this week that couldn't land. Heaviest export lambs over 30 kilos, 186 to a top of 236 at a ballpark cost of 640 to 650 cents. Heavy 26 to 30 kilo lambs, 156 to $195. Heavy trades, 147 to 160. These lambs averaging between 610 and 640 cents. Sheep back under $3 a kilo again. Heavy crossbred ewes, $75 to $95. Jenny Kelly for MLA.
Thanks very much for that, Jenny. A lot going on there. Thanks for that information. Let's go to Wagga Cattle and Leanne Dax.
Agents yarded 5,800 cattle, 1,000 less than drawn for. Despite the shortfall, all regular buyers attended the sale and were actively participating. However, competition did fluctuate at times, leading to market correction of 20 cents with sporadic instances of greater declines. In the cow market, traction diminished considerably with both heavy and leaner types slipping by 20 cents, with stall cow reductions of 20 to 40 cents. Prime vealers were limited in number and fetched 290 to 362. Trade heifers sold up to 295 cents, while the steer portion ranged from 328 to 335. Feedlot buyers showed reluctance towards the higher prices seen the previous week, resulting in a 20 cent decline. Medium weight sold from 270 to 367, with the occasional sale out to 374. Feeder heifers of medium weight faced weakened demand, slipping 5 to 9 cents, predominantly selling from 250 to 324. In the export market, there was occasional glimpses of price spurts, although some buyers remained subdued. Leanne Dax, MLA.
Thanks very much for that, Leanne. To Mortlake Cattle, take it away, Chris Agnew.
Agents yarded 2,785 head at Mortlake, a similar number to the previous week's offering. It was a good offering over most categories for the top end, however not as good as the previous sale overall, with a number of cattle still starting to show the effects of the dry cattle in most sections and more so in the trade cattle section. Not all the regular processors are present, with two major processors absent and active in a market which was very soft over most categories, lacking motivation to be 20 to 30 cents cheaper and more in places over all categories sold so far. As this is an interim report and there are still trade cattle and 1,236 cows still yet to be offered. The trade steers and heifers marking between 265 and 305. Grown cattle have topped out at 330 cents and the manufacturing steers sold up to 275 cents. At Mortlake, this is Chris Agnew reporting for MLA.
Lucky last is Pakenham and Brendan Fletcher.
G'day, Warwick. Numbers increased to 1,840. That's 120 more, with the usual buying group operating in a cheaper market in places. Quality declined, with a larger proportion lacking finish. Well-finished trade lots sold from firm to 10 cents easier. Plainer types gave back more. Grown steers and bullocks lost 5 to 10 cents. Crossbred manufacturing steers eased 7. The Frisian portion lost 25. Vealers sold from 235 to 402, yearling trade steers 310 to 410, the heifer portion 257 to 400, grown steers 273 to 336, bullocks 312 to 332, heavy Frisian steers 228 to 255, crossbreds 240 to 326. This is Brendan Fletcher reporting, with nearly 500 cows still to be sold.
Thanks very much for that, Brendan. That's all the time we have for you on the Country Hour today. Remember, you can always send us an email, countryhour@abc.net.au, or download the Victorian Country Hour podcast. Just search that term wherever you get your podcasts. Talk tomorrow.